radioalburn.com.
Welcome to Truth Without Radio. Today's date is Friday the 27th of December 2019, and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, and we are broadcasting live tonight at radioalbion.com because we have with us the producer of Adolf Hitler, The Greatest Story Never Told, Communism by the Back Door, and the newly finished Freemasonic Victors of World War III. Dennis, I almost forgot that last title there. How are you doing, sir? Merry Christmas to you.
Merry Christmas, yeah. Well, it's now gone, right? But Happy New Year. Certainly a mouthful every week for you, Sven. I do feel for you, but I do pick these long titles.
Well, they seem to do well, though, don't they? I mean, it's, people would probably say, well, they're not that catchy, but people do remember them because it's like a sentence, isn't it?
Yeah.
Greatest story never told. Communism by the back door. I just get tripped up because, like you say, I'm sort of talking about them every week. I noticed you've had... Yeah, you've had loads of comments on that last episode. Lots of support for you, I see there.
Yeah, I was pleased with the end result. As you know, it took quite some time, and I wasn't happy. And unless I'm happy, then it doesn't go up. But eventually, it went up, and I was pleased, and it looked like everybody else was as well.
Yeah, I've had a look at some of the documentaries that have come out since your ones, because that was really groundbreaking, the first one, Adolf Hitler, The Greatest Story Never Told. There was nothing else like that. I think there have been things like something that was called The Ring, I believe it was, and that other one that begins with Z, it escapes my mind now, but none of them were really about World War II. They were more sort of conspiracy style sort of things, and since your documentaries have come out, there's been one, Apotheosis of Evil, that I saw the other day, and Europa, The Last Battle, which I was very, very impressed with. It sort of following the same content line, but going much more in depth. And I don't think any of those would have been possible without your documentaries first breaking the mold. And doing
well, somebody once got in touch with me and said, how do I feel about, what's it called? I forgot what it's called.
Europa, the final battle, or Europa, the last battle, that's it.
And I said, well, I haven't got a problem with it. I mean, I spoke with the people who produced it. I even advised on it, and I even let them use, some footage that I'd use, and I'm also talking on it at some point. So I said, there's no reason for me to have a problem. I mean, as long as the one that I did inspires other people to bring out these type of eye-opening documentaries, and certainly this one is. The difference I felt was that although I was doing mine in 50-minute parts, they were doing theirs in one-hour parts and going not always on the same subject, but obviously a lot of it's the same subject, and going much deeper, like you just mentioned.
I did hear you on there, and I also heard Matt Heimbach on there, and I think on the other one, Apotheosis of Evil, I heard and saw Mark Cullett on there. I think one of the problems with it, though, is that it was so long. I wasn't able to actually watch all of it because it's 12 hours in all. I mean,
twice the length, yeah.
Yours are about 6 hours, and in 15-minute chunks, they're much easier to digest. I mean, that would be my only criticism of it, is that you can't watch it all in one hit.
Yeah, well, I've been criticised. I think it's, I'm not sure if it's Metapedia or one of the pages anyway, for doing these long, bone-numbing documentaries. but this one's certainly twice as long, so, I have a problem with that one.
Well, they're not bum-numbing. I mean, you're glued to the screen the whole time when you're watching these things. Yeah. And when you think about it, I mean, what did the BBC do? The World at War? Something like that. And I seem to remember that was so long. It seemed to go on all year. It must be about 12 hours long.
A huge propaganda documentary. I think that was just specifically made for that Next Generation of the 70s. It was really well publicized, and I've tore it to bits in recent years because they've obviously come out with stuff which has since been, you know, rebuffed.
Well, this is the thing, isn't it? I don't think any of us would have thought years ago that we'd be able to counter those huge, great, long documentaries that the mainstream media was making, and yet we now have the tools to do that, and we've got people like yourself doing it.
I'll give you one example where one guy comes on and adamant that the flames were leaping out of the chimney as the bodies were burning, but as we've come to know, the chimney was never linked to anything. It just goes straight into the ground. It was built by the Russians in 47. Another woman was saying, I think she was German as well, and she was saying, I saw these people turning into what was it? I can't remember what she was saying now, but whatever she was saying, the Holocaust Museum itself had debunked.
Again, lampshades.
Sorry.
Soap, lampshades, both of those were debunked.
I think it was soap. I mean, they're so ridiculous. Like, I don't tend to keep them at the forefront of my mind. But yeah, and she was on for a long spell, and really, you know, given it the fact that she was actually there and saw it. So, you know.
Oh, there are some incredible lies told, isn't there? There's that woman that was brought up by wolves, and the one that was pooping out diamonds. I mean, a lot of these were shown in the Europa Last Battle episode. The last one I saw, I think, it was chapter 9. I got up to chapter 9. But yeah, really, really impressed with it, and just, you know, so pleased that we've got people that are that talented. They can produce this sort of information. The big difference I would have thought actually with it was that they actually had a narrator, and in your ones it's held together with text, isn't it?
Which has its own in many benefits. You're in a situation with The Great Story Never Told where you can't really leave it running and go in the kitchen and make a brew because you'll miss the text. So it does keep you pinned and more concentrated, I suppose. But certainly, you know, there's nothing wrong with having a narration through like they used. They did a great job, and some of the visuals were really excellent as well. So I enjoyed it. I really did.
Well, one bonus or benefit that there is to having text bits linking it all together is that that text can be translated into another language. So you could have a Persian version of your documentary. You could have a Chinese version of it. I'm sure the Japanese would be interested in it.
There's quite a few on YouTube at one point, different translations, which is true, as you say, and people saw the documentary and felt moved enough to inspire him to actually translate. And we even had different translations on the website when you could actually buy the DVD. So a lot of people saw it and was inspired, I think.
It's a great shame that YouTube have just sort of done away with all this stuff, because there was a time when you could go on YouTube and you could just find the most amazing documentaries on all different subjects and all to do with the truth movement. You know, you could find stuff on chemtrails, you could find stuff on the Illuminati, on these families, rich families that rule the world, and then you could find your stuff on World War II, you could find all of that, and it's all just gone. It's not there anymore, and people are having to put up their own websites and put their own content on there, and it's just a great shame that it's no longer there on YouTube.
Well, I think the problem was that it was a Zionist platform to start with, so we got away with what we got away with. Probably got away with more than what they ever realised we could do. And again, it's true. I went on a website the other day, and they had, I think it was the Cole documentary, which had been on YouTube in different numbers of parts. And as you look down, you know, again, it's this scrapyard we're talking about: blank video, blank video, blank video, blank video.
That looks such a mess, doesn't it? Such a mess. You go on a website and there used to be YouTube links there, and it's all just gone. Well, thankfully we have got BitChute. At least we've got BitChute, and they seem to be holding up. That's where you're publishing your content now. That's where everybody seems to be publishing now. They've got Discus comments there, And there are quite a few comments I noticed that we haven't actually addressed. Some quite good subjects in there as well. So I thought maybe we could get into some of these today, some of these comments there. And the first one was addressed to you, Dennis. And it was somebody that wanted to know, did Pope Pius XII fund Hitler? So tell us about that.
Yeah, this is a lady who sometimes comments on the actual documentary. And she asked that, and I said, without really, you know, any hesitation, yes. And then that was followed by somebody who asked me, have you got any proof of that? And without hesitation, I said no. But what I really meant, and went on to explain, was the fact that we know they met with the Vatican, and the Vatican pulled the centre party so Hitler could become dictator of Germany. He won back all Europe for Christianity by 1941. And then, not forgetting, at the end of the war, when the Vatican didn't need to, they kind of made sure the Axis soldiers were taken out of Europe and transferred down to South America. And numerous other things. I mean, about 1946, I learned that they sent a lot of gold down there to keep these people living in a decent standard down in Argentina. So my point being was, if they were going to go to all that trouble at the end of the war and even, you know, move their own centre party to close so Hitler could come to power, I'm quite sure if Hitler needed, you know, a bit of funding for an election campaign, he only need ask.
Well, he was standing against the communists. I mean, this was the thing. The communists were going to take over, and the church knew what the communists would do if the communists were to take power. So the National Socialists were like a bulwark between the Catholic Church and what was happening in the Soviet Union. So, I mean, even if they weren't directly funding them, they would have, you know, companies that the Catholic Church had invested in, I should imagine, would have been working with the National Socialists, and they would be funding
one of the richest organizations in the world anyway. So it's not like they'd have been struggling for funds. So, I mean, it's so obvious sometimes. It's like the similar thing with once you know that the American bankers subsidized the Russian Revolution, and once they won that revolution, that they would not hand it over to anybody, they would run it and put people in charge. You don't really need any proof after that because, you know, the Soviet Union was what it was. It was a proxy for the bankers.
That's another thing that's really showed in that Europa Last Battle, is the build up with communism and how that worked with the Bolsheviks and Stalin before Stalin.
Were they brutal?
Savage, absolutely savage. I mean, some of those images, they're just sort of, you know, seared onto your brain. You know, depravity that you just wouldn't think possible. It's horrific what the East Europeans went through. It's very emotional. Again, it's very emotional watching your documentary, and it's emotional watching that last battle as well. And I've no doubt that there's more to come out yet. I mean, this information about the Catholic Church and a lot of that, I mean, that's just new information that you've come up with in your series, Dennis.
I mean, I looked for it for a long time. I always believed it, but it's obviously finding the evidence. It's never difficult because they did spend 5 years in Germany, shut shop and removed everything that they could, but they can't always remove everything. And sometimes they even slip up the cells. Like some of the documentaries that I've used in the past were made, you know, maybe in the 60s, 70s, and admit to what went on because, you know, there's no means of anybody getting in trouble now.
I mean, that bit where that they exhibited the cloak or whatever it was and the crown jewels and was it 2 million people? 2 million?
Yeah, the robe,
Yeah, 2 million, what is the word? I keep forgetting words
tonight.
Pilgrims, that's it, pilgrims. Yeah. 2 million pilgrims arrived for that, to see them exhibiting this robe, and they had the SS outside. I mean, that's just, I don't think anybody knew anything about that. Bishop Williamson didn't know anything about it when I interviewed him.
Well, I mean, there's a lot been hidden. I mean, I even found some just of the week, there was a headline in one of the papers of that time that when Germany went into Poland, France actually went into the Reich. Now, I never knew that. I thought things went pretty slowly till, you know, the Brits came over and the war kicked off after a quiet period. But apparently the French went into the Reich, must have been pushed back. But I never knew that before.
Yeah, I'll be interesting to find out more about that. Oh, another thing I'd like to learn more about is that when the Poles pushed back against the Soviets at the end of the First World War.
1920s.
Yeah. Apparently Hitler had a lot of respect for the Poles doing that. And, you know, he got on very well with the former leader of Poland that unfortunately passed away.
Yeah.
And then this new guy came in that was on the side of the Allies, basically, and didn't want to make peace with Germany. But up until that point, Hitler had a lot of respect for the Poles and for them fighting against the Soviets. And again, that's something we don't hear about, this war that Poland had with the Soviets, with the Bolsheviks, basically.
It's funny you should mention that, because even just the other day, Putin was cracking up, believe it or not, because there was an attempt by the Poles to put up a statue of Hitler at one point, because he promised to move all the Jews out of Poland into Africa, which these Poles were obviously highly delighted with. Never came about, but the actual statue was removed, and Putin was furious to find out that such a thing was ever suggested.
Well, there's a big issue, isn't there, with Russia and Germany and what happened during that war. On the one hand, the Russians are proud of defeating Germany, but on the other hand, I mean, look what the Red Army did, and look what was done to the Russians by the Soviets. So they've got something that they want to be proud of. Well, we defeated Germany, but at the same time, you know, it was these savages that were in that Red Army that had all been released from the Siberian jails.
And they actually had a statue of a Russian soldier raping one of these women either in Germany or were they Axis countries?
It was in Poland.
And that has to be removed, covered up and removed. I mean, the thought of whoever decided to sculpture that and have it displayed, it's just, you know, beyond imagination, isn't it?
Right. Well, I think it was deliberately done, wasn't it? I mean, it must have cost quite a lot to do that. I mean, it was a statue showing what went on, basically the truth that the Red Army just raped their way across Germany, and it was put in a really important place at night. I mean, it must have had a lot of transport to actually put it there, and then they removed it the next day, didn't they? I'm not sure if they even know who it was that put it there.
Sick though, you know.
Well, that's what he was pointing to. He wasn't celebrating it. He was saying, "Look, this is what went on." That's why they removed it straight away.
Got you. Yeah, right.
Quite an audacious thing to do, to put a huge sculpture like that wherever it was, and in front of the Polish government or whatever. Yeah, wasn't celebrating it.
As it shows in the Europa documentary, you know, just how brutal the Bolsheviks were in their own country at that time. But when they went out into places like Hungary and, you know, the Axis countries and Germany, you know, filled with hate, they were even more brutal.
You know, the effects of it still going on today, aren't they, in the Ukraine? If you think they starved everybody in the Ukraine and then they killed all the intelligentsia. So what you've got left in the Ukraine is, you know, not the offspring of not very intelligent people, the ones that were left. And on top of that, you know, they've got this hatred of Russia because of what was done to them. But as you discover, the majority of the people in the Soviets were these Jewish communists from abroad that were running things that were sent there from New York by these bankers.
They weren't Russians. But then
you've got the Russians talking about how proud they are of defeating Germany with the Red Army. So you've got a real tangled mess, basically, over there in Germany.
It's true that when fighting broke out in the Ukraine a couple of years ago now, there was like people from nationalist countries who fought in World War II, like Croatia. There were people going down there, mercenaries, fighting on the side of the Ukrainians because of the, you know, they knew what the story had been with the Soviets in World War II, and they're going to go down there and try to get back some kind of revenge.
You know, what I think about is, you know, just, you know, the brave people that fought against them to prevent that from happening to Western Europe. You know, it happened to Eastern Europe, but thanks to Hitler and the Waffen-SS and all the brave people that volunteered, you know, the British Freikorps and the Legion from Latvia, the Estonians, I mean, legions and Waffen-SS from all over Europe went to fight on that that Eastern Front. And it was only because of that Stalin didn't come straight into Europe while Germany was battling Britain.
Yeah, that's been still being disputed today. But as I mentioned in one of the documentaries, it's actually in Leonid Brezhnev's memoirs. And he should know, being, you know, once the president of Russia, that he admitted that Stalin was going to invade. And even when the wall came down and the archives opened, it was all there to say that Stalin was going to invade. And he even mentioned it in the greatest story right at the end there. I told you who signed the paper and what date it was signed and when the invasion was going to be. All that came from the archives.
And the Germans had worked with the Russian nationalists, and they'd sorted out like a plan of what was going to happen, and they'd get rid of the commissars, and then the responsibility for Russia would be going into the hands of the Russian nationalists, and they'd be able to put the churches back up again. They'd get rid of all the communist ideas, and the place would be run by them basically. And they had like a unit of these Russian nationalists that were fighting with the Germans to try to liberate their country, because that's what it was. They were trying to liberate Russia, not trying to take the place over and invade Europe. It was fighting to preserve Europe.
Cossacks. One section.
Yeah, I don't know if they covered that in the last battle. I know you did.
Well, I did. I did because one of the reasons that I did was because of the guy in charge. He kind of epitomized the morals of the German general, where not only did he say that any rapes or anything like that would be, you know, cured by hanging. Right at the end, when the Cossacks were forced back, they were fighting for 3 days, beaten onto trains with either drugs or baseball bats. He went back with them because he spent time with them, and he actually said, "Like, I've been in, you know, good times with the Cossacks, and I will not leave them in bad times." And he went back with the Cossacks to the Soviet Union and was put on trial and executed.
Incredible bravery and chivalry and honour that went on. I mean, we talk about the wickedness of Churchill and Roosevelt and Stalin, but at the same time, there was incredible nobility actually among the people that were fighting against the Soviets. And, you know, like the Latvian SS, you know, and the Lithuanian, they laid down their lives to just hold back the Red Army for long enough so that ships could leave, taking refugees of Lithuanians and Latvians. And, you know, they had these last stands against the Bolsheviks. And, you know, they knew they were going to die. But because of what they did, you know, millions of their people or hundreds of thousands of their people were able to escape and survived. It's an incredible story. Incredible. It's just not, you know, it's just not told apart from in the alternative media.
Yes, because we're back to the victors writing, you know, the history again, where anything like that would be swept under the carpet and even denied.
Well, yeah, they don't want there to be any nuance to it, do they? It's just Hitler was a madman, and everybody that followed him was mad, and they're all bad, and that's all you need to know.
Yeah.
And if you're going to say anything else, we're going to lock you up. And that's basically it.
That's basically what it is, yeah.
And thankfully, we don't have you know, the Holocaust denial laws here in Britain, but, you know, most of Europe, unfortunately, has them.
I noticed Trump brought out some more anti-Semitic laws last week, as did Boris Johnson was planning some. So things are going to get, you know, tougher.
Yeah, they're very, both of them are very supportive of right-wing Jewry, supportive of Zionism. Yeah. Let's get back into these comments here, and the rest of them, or quite a large substance of them, deals with Christianity, as usual, and accusations that the National Socialists weren't Christian. And one person, because they make various you know, they point to various reasons for why they're saying this. And one of them I thought was particularly funny, and that's a suggestion that the National Socialists must have been pagans because Adolf Hitler liked a Viking ship at the arts festival. And that's basically his argument, because Hitler obviously liked this Viking ship, and apparently the Vikings were anti-Christian, so he had to have been anti-Christian. But, I mean, this was an arts festival celebrating European culture. So, of course, it's going to have Viking ships at it. It's going to have representatives of the Celtic tribes, the Roman tribes, the Saxon tribes. And, you know, the Vikings were brave people, brave seafaring people. They had their bad points. They had their good points as well. But I wouldn't say that just because somebody likes the Vikings or the Viking ships, that they had to be anti-Christian. You may get a small subset of nationalists today that idolize Vikings and think of them as somehow being anti-Christian at their core. But I don't think that was central to them. Central to them was buccaneering and, you know, slashing and burning and raping and pillaging and, well, and doing it wherever they could.
Not well, it's funny you say that, because, I mean, this kind of parade has been used over the years as an example of the paganism. And yet, the story they tell is that Hitler pretended to be Christian and was secretly a pagan. Whereas at this particular time, this parade's going past and he's publicly on display watching this parade go past. So it kind of blows up in the face the story that he was a secret pagan, if this, you know, was actually true that it was a pagan parade. But it's about culture and heritage of the past in Europe. And I just happened to say to the guy, look, you know, two Viking ships is two Viking ships in a parade. I said, and I can even twist it that the Vikings acted like Bolsheviks with the, you just, as you just said, raped and pillaged. And then he accused me of believing victors again. He said that, you know, Vikings never raped and pillaged. And I just said to him, "Oh, good luck with you. If you want to convince people with that story, then good luck." But, you know, I wasn't buying it myself.
They did a lot of raping and pillaging. You know, I mean, it's in their own books, so you know they brag about it, and it's in our Anglo-Saxon books that's what we're on.
Well, they're internationalists as well, because they used to go around invading other countries like the Bolsheviks,
and destroying all the literary accomplishments as well. I mean, that's what happened in Britain. Yeah, they burnt down the monasteries, and in doing so, they destroyed all the scrolls. And by about 870, there was nobody left in London that could actually read or write legible Latin. You know, they destroyed the education system so much. That was before they actually became Christian. And then when they became Christian, they settled down. And they were good neighbours then. And then you get this Nordic civilisation. But before then, they were really just buccaneers.
Yeah, they were brave as they were. A lot of people think they discovered America, which is fair enough, quite possible.
So, you know, it's this spirit that we have, you know, as white people, you know, of excitement and adventure, and it needs to be channeled in the right direction. And the right direction was, I believe, was in colonizing, you know, the rest of the world, going out there and building civilizations in America and in Australia. And it was the same spirit that did that, was this the same spirit that sort of went over to Britain and invaded Britain and started burning and destroying things. It just trying to conquer. It was just channeled in the wrong direction. It needed to be channeled towards something more positive. I mean, that arts festival, I mean, that gets put up as, well, this is proof that they were pagan because they had this. And I mean, it's just a carnival and a celebration of what it means to be European. And obviously, Europe has a history that goes back before Christianity, and you're going to have things from before Christianity. It doesn't mean that you're pagan. I mean, I'm interested in all of Europe's history. It didn't just begin 2,000 years ago. I'm interested in everything that happened before then. And, you know, I have bits and pieces that represent that around my home. It doesn't mean that I'm a pagan. It just means I love my people and I love my history. And that's what those celebrations were about. It was about celebrating what it means to be European, celebrating your heritage. I mean, this is why they were using runes. It wasn't because of, you know, it was some bizarre black magic ritual. It was just using the old language. And trying to find out what it meant.
I believe in Sweden, they're now destroying the history there. There were some not long back, a couple of months ago, I heard that there were some Viking treasures destroyed. They just want to wipe it off and get a different cultured people into Sweden and tell them a fresh history. So, you know, that history may not be with us for that long, if you know what I mean.
Well, yeah, I think in Sweden, the culture minister is non-white, and she was the one that sort of actioned that, the melting down of these ancient gold antiques, basically.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, it's all being destroyed. If you know, like Notre Dame, it's just being burnt down. You know, if we don't take care of our heritage, it will be destroyed. We can see that's the aim of a lot of these left-wing movements is to just tear that down, like they've torn down the statues in America of the pioneers. Yeah. Like you've got the Tear Down Cecil Rhodes movement that has moved into tearing down anything white within our, or representative of white people in our universities. You know, and you can trace that back to the Bolsheviks of tearing down everything, smash everything, and then we will rebuild it. That was the idea, and it becomes all about just get rid of anything that shows the history of white people. I think that ISIS were doing the same, you know, out there in Syria.
And don't forget they've got Hollywood to put black people in Robin Hood now and other kind of early films to convince people that, you know, I even saw a website at one point said that the blacks were the first people of Britain being taught in a school in Britain.
Yeah, they've done that a few times, haven't they? The BBC have done that with their cartoons and said that there were black Romans, Hadrian's Wall was built by blacks, Cheddar Man, he was black. And there's no actual evidence for that. It's all just propaganda to make people go along with diversity.
That's exactly what it is.
Well, we've got some more metaphysical questions next. We've got a commenter called Mark Wilson, and he asks a load of questions, which are obviously some of them are directed at you quite cynically, but some of the subjects are interesting to get into. And the first thing that he asks about is demons, because you mentioned something about the fact that, you know, our enemies believe in them, and that's what matters. But yeah, do you want to talk a little bit about demons? Because he's trying to say that, he tries to ridicule you and make out that, you know, you're talking about you've seen demons or something. So,
he wasn't actually sticking up for demons. He was saying there were no demons. And because we're talking about Jesus Christ, and I've said I've always had the belief that utter the words Jesus Christ and a demon backs off. I've been told this many years before, you know, and he kind of belittled the thought that there were any demons. And he said, you know, you've never seen any demons, and you know, this is all made up and all this kind of carry on. And I said, well, to be honest, you know, I haven't seen any demons, but I do believe that there are. And my only argument, all right, you know, reasoning with these people is to say, if you don't believe in demons, fair enough. I will go out and buy an Ouija board, and then you can let your children play with the Ouija board over weekend. Would you really allow that? And I have met one person who doesn't believe in demons say yes.
I did hear that there was, what was it? They were doing some children's book on children's book with an alphabet, and it was an alphabetical name for a different demon. And it was proper demons, and that's just come out over Christmas, like a Christmas book for kids put out by the left.
And there are exorcists in the Roman Catholic Church, or what I call, you know, the previous Roman Catholic Church, who actually performed exorcisms. It was only the Roman Catholic Church who actually performed them. And there's even footage on YouTube of a girl in Italy being exorcised.
Yeah, it was all systematized, and they had protocols for it, and to see if it was real or not. You know, they wouldn't have done all that if there wasn't some truth to it. I think, if you think the amount of people that think that they're the wrong gender, and they've got this idea in their heads that they're a different gender, and they're almost like different people when they are, you know, dressed up as if they are a different gender. And you could understand that, you know, 2,000 years ago, that would have been seen as if somebody was possessed by a demon.
Yeah, true. Yeah, it would have been looked on that. Yeah, it's just
schizophrenia,
witchcraft. you know, is accepted today. But, you know, 200 or 300 years ago, you know, they'd have been thrown in a river and checked if they'd drown or not. And if they drowned, then they were all right. But if they weren't, they were a witch. Then they got burnt at stake.
Pharmacopoeia, wasn't it? Years ago, they called it pharmacopoeia. And today it's drugs. I mean, and that was witchcraft.
Yes.
You know, just the drugs that, you know, recreational drugs. That was witchcraft years ago. But, the thing is that our enemies believe in demons. They believe in them.
I'm sure they do, yeah. Well, I'm sure Freemasons do. I mean, there's enough books written by Freemasons on the raising of demons. I mean, Manly P. Hall actually tells you how to do it. And the safe way to do it.
What's the best way of getting away with something if nobody actually believes you exist? I mean, the devil can get away with anything if people don't believe the devil exists.
Well, that's the problem. A lot of people will believe in aliens before they believe in, God. And I do believe some of these alien sightings are all, you know, to do with demons. I don't think they're from outer space. They're interdimensional.
Could well be. And then he makes some other observations or questions. And he says, who determined the Bible to be holy? And that's probably quite a good question, really, that, you know, people might ask. The reason why the Bible is holy is because it was written over 600 years, something like that. If you think 600 BC to 1 AD, maybe longer than that. And yet it's as if it's written by the same person. That's why they talk about the Holy Ghost, because it all fits together. And it fits together in ways that weren't even known at the time. Like things would have been written in 400 BC that only made sense in 1 AD, and nobody had been able to understand them before. So the fact that it all fits together shows that there was a driving spirit that was behind it, which is why people talk about the Holy Spirit or the Holy Ghost, that was inspiring it. So it was divinely inspired because it all fits together like that. So that's what determines that the Bible is holy, is that it couldn't be anything else. Man is not capable of doing something like that. It has to be man inspired by something else. So that's why the Bible was determined to be holy. It's written in different places, different authors, yet it all fits together. Yeah. You know, they didn't have like a guide, like the TV companies have a guide today. You are Doctor Who season whatever. Well, this is your guide on what the Daleks have done and the rest of it. Yeah. You know, it wasn't like that. It was holy men and prophets saying things that they felt inspired to say, that was then written down by the scribes. You know, it couldn't be faked or made by man.
Well, out of the Bible came the Ten Commandments, and I was talking to a young lad just the other night about it, and he doesn't believe in God, and, you know, it was only to be expected. But I said to him, I said, we need the Ten Commandments, and he kind of looked at me puzzled. And I said, well, the reason we need them is because atheists believe they don't need any laws to know what's right or wrong. And I said, the problem with that is that person A may have a set of morals, but person B may have worse morals. So where do you draw the line? If there's no kind of guide or a commandment or a law to say this is wrong, then anything goes. And he kind of agreed in a way.
Well, that's it, isn't it? You know, the Bible, and with the law of the Bible, all the time we took to that, then the kings couldn't break that. And you could always appeal to that. You could always appeal to the church, and the church would say, well, you know, this is wrong. And then the king would obey them out of the fear of God. And then you have a system that works there. I think that one of the most important commandments that gets overlooked is honor your father and your mother. And people just think that means honor your mum and dad, but no, it doesn't. I mean, which mother and which father does that mean? Because you've got, you know, scores of mothers and fathers going all the way back. So what can that possibly mean? Well, it means you must marry within your race. That's how you honor every one of your mothers and every one of your fathers. You know, if you're white, you marry somebody else who's white, and then you've honored every single one of them, because every single one of them was white if you are white. I mean, it's the same if you're black and you marry somebody who's black. But that's what it means to honor your father and your mother. It means to honor every single one of them. And that's the only way that you can do that, is to marry somebody else who looks like you and produce somebody else who looks like them, who looks like your ancestors. Yeah. And that was the meaning of it.
Well, it's like in The Great Story, I used Muhammad Ali for such an example, where he said, Parkinson said he was quite happy for, his girl, his daughter, to bring home a black lad. And Muhammad Ali said, no, that's not right. He says, if somebody marries a Chinese man, he's going to go into, yin-tang music, and the Western woman isn't going to particularly like that kind of music. She'll play other music, which will annoy him, and the things don't mix together. And like you said, bluebirds fight with bluebirds. Even the animals know what's right and wrong. So, and he said that no white person should really ever want their grandchildren to be dark-skinned with curly hair. And he was only speaking for his own race. He loved his race.
He was spot on. And the guy interviewing him, that Parkinson, you could see he was squirming and he was all uncomfortable.
BBC left winger, yeah.
At being told this. But, it's quite true. I mean, why would the blue whale, be attracted to the humpback whale? And why would the blue whale care what the humpback whale thought of him? The blue whales go with the blue whales, the humpback whales go with the humpback whales, the sperm whales go with the sperm whales. They stick with their own.
That's happy. Yep.
They don't all mix and mingle. I think whales are a very good analogy, for the races, different races of human. You got different races of whale. This idea that we should be concerned about what another race thinks of us is ridiculous. It's just used to batter white people over the head with it.
It's to break the family, isn't it? That's the attempt.
And try and encourage us to mix and match. Well, his next point, he says, why were some books used in the Bible and not others? And because they didn't want to have spurious books in there. That was the reason. And then you get to the question of, well, who was it that was deciding what was spurious and what was not? And then you had councils of scholars that looked through them all, particularly with the New Testament. They had all these different scholars, and they took about 200 years doing it, checking everything out to make sure that only the ones that could be verified by witnesses and everything else were actually put in there. And the Old Testament, there were other books that are mentioned in the Old Testament that aren't actually included in the Old Testament. There was, I guess they must have had more books available to them than they actually used in the Septuagint. And then the Septuagint was this collection that was written in Hebrew, and Alexander the Great said, well, this ought to be translated into Greek. So he got these Hebrew scholars together and put them each in a separate dwelling place that they had, and said, can you translate this? Can you translate this into Greek? And they did, and every one of them came out with the same translation. And at that time, they were memorizing things through mnemonics. So they would have been able to remember the whole of the Old Testament and reel it off, because they got this. Every one of them got it exactly the same as the other. And that was written down into Greek. But I should imagine they had the same way of seeing whether these books were spurious. Because it also says in the Old Testament that the way to tell whether a prophet is true is whether what he says comes true. So obviously you would have to wait a while to see whether what they'd said comes true. So, you've got books there that are 500 years old or whatever, and they could say, well, that book should definitely be included. That man who wrote that had the spirit of truth within him, because what he prophesied came true. Okay. So they took their time overdoing this. That's why you've got some books that are in there, and some that aren't. It doesn't mean that the ones that aren't in there have no value, because they give us an idea of the way that people were interpreting these things back then. And a lot of them became the Apocrypha. And he asks about the Apocrypha as well. And I've got a good quote here, actually. And I really don't think that much of the Anglicans, but they seem to have a good idea here. And this is: the Anglican communion accepts the Apocrypha for instruction in life and manners, but not for the establishment of doctrine. So if it's got a teaching in the Apocrypha that is different to what it has in the Bible, then it shouldn't be used. But for understanding what life was like back then, and the customs that people had, and the way that they interpreted these prophecies, that's what the Apocrypha is for. And the Apocrypha was originally included in some of the old Bibles and included in the Protestant Bibles, and it's still there as part of the King James Version. And it's the intertestamental scriptures. It's basically what took place between the Old Testament and the New Testament. And it's very useful, I think. There's some fantastic books in there. And, I mean, there may even be a bit that it benefited the Jews not to have the Apocrypha included, because there's bits in it that talk about the tribes of Israel and them leaving the captivity in Persia and making their way into Europe in the book of Ezra, which, you know, it shows that the Jews aren't who they say they are. So it may be that it was under Jewish pressure that the Apocrypha got left out. So he's...
Well, the thing is with this substitute, what they now used to be a theory, they're now stating and teaching as facts about this. The earth wasn't created, it was this big bang. You know, from nothing came something. And, in the Bible, it talked in thousands of years, doesn't talk in millions of years. And yet we see the dinosaurs being brought forward from millions of years ago. And there's a conflict in these two, let's just call them theories for now. And the fact is that one is trying to get rid of the other, especially in the education system. And really, you know, these are things that haven't been proven. And I don't believe that I come from a monkey. I just really don't believe that. And I was listening to an old chief talking the other day on YouTube, and he says, the monkey's, you know, he's not my relative. It could be my ancestor, but he's not my relative. And, you know, even the Indians don't believe we came from monkeys. So it's just all these things have been coming up since Darwin. It's all been happening past couple of hundred years. Previous to them, there was no dinosaur bones ever found. It's just this, and I've touched on this in the Secret Masonic Victory, where it's an attempt, I believe, to destroy God and the belief, because we go to Europe now and kids will believe that there's life on other planets rather than actually believing God.
Yeah, I don't have a problem with there being dinosaurs, because I tend to have a different understanding of the creation as it is. Before I get into that, though, I'll just say that, you know, the ancients believed that we were closer to the bee than the monkey.
Really?
That shows you just how far we've fallen, because they looked at the way that the bee lived and the way that he lived in like a structure with lots of other bees, and they built, you know, these hexagonal honeycombs, and they all had a different role to fulfill. And it was a city, it was a civilization that they had there within the beehive. So they saw that structure, that social structure. Man is a part of the social structure. So the closest we are, the closest living thing to us is the bee. So that was the way that they looked at it. Darwin is looking, oh, it's just a man, two legs and a man on his own. He's not thinking of the social structure that's required in order for man to live. And if you look at the social structure, man needs all this social structure in order to live. Then you understand that we couldn't have evolved from anywhere. We couldn't have just gradually got more and more complicated as an individual being. I mean, that's nonsense. The only way things could have happened, this is the way I see it, is everything was created at once. So, and the creation story tells us that Adam was created, and he wasn't created as a baby that grew into an adult. He was created as an adult. He was a fully grown adult. And the earth, the way I see it, the earth would have been created as a fully grown earth. So Adam would have been just created, but the world that he was living in, it would have had mountains there, it would have had trees, it would have looked like it had been there for a million years, but it had just been created that instant, because everything is needed. You can't have, you know, if you just look at something like trees, for instance,
they
break down and they die. The worms eat the leaves, and the worms then create the soil, and the seeds go into the soil, and the tree grows. So you have to have a cycle of hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years before trees can actually grow in that soil. But the soil itself is made up from the trees. So where did the trees come from if you didn't have soil there at first, because you didn't have the worms? Because you'd have to have the trees first for the worms to eat the trees. Yet, you know, the worms also have to have the trees there first. so that they can eat them. You know, it's the chicken or the egg thing. Whatever you look around the world, you know, you can't say, well, did that appear first or did that appear first? Because they both rely on one another, and the whole world relies on everything else. So it couldn't have just started and evolved like this. I think there is evolution. Our imaginary world that we live in, that evolves, and that gets more and more complex. And we, as we discover things and we discover more minute ways of measuring things, it becomes more and more complex, this imaginary world that we live in. But basically our senses just tell us that the earth is flat and there's a firmament above us. But the world that we've constructed through measurement and telescopes and discovering everything around us tells us that it's much more than that. But our senses, you know, they tell us that it's just flat and there's something above us, that the thing that stars are hanging in. And that's how it would have appeared at first to Adam.
Well,
and it's just more complex now. But that's still the imaginary world. Go on, Dennis.
I read the other day that the gorilla is 95% of man, which I find hard to believe, especially when, you know, if you're going to have a heart operation, they'll use a valve of a pig. So even a pig is closer than what a monkey is. But I can't see where they're getting 95% gorilla compared to a man.
Well, they tell us that, I think, is it 98% of our DNA we share with a banana or something like that? Everything's built out of the same. Everything's built out of the same building blocks. But before we lost our faith, we saw ourselves as the pinnacle of creation. You know, we were the children of God. We were the final thing that he created to tend the creation. We were above the angels. And the minute we stopped believing in God, we now believe that we are descended from apes, monkeys. Yeah. You know, these badly behaved, disgusting, immoral, you know, foul creatures they are. If you look at the countries where these monkeys live and the sort of things these monkeys do, I mean, it's a great insult to think that you're descended from a monkey. And the other choice was, you know, we're the children of God and we're the pinnacle of civilization, pinnacle of creation is what we were before. So it seems to me that that's the punishment for turning our back on God, is that people have been sent a delusion that they come from monkeys.
Well, like I said, I mean, I don't think we're meant to understand it, because whoever created this world, and, you know, like I said, this old Indian believed in the creator, he called him the grandfather. You know, it's like an ant finding a laptop. It just can't do anything with it. It's just too far advanced. And it's like, there's things that we can't understand. It's impossible to understand the eye itself has something like 197 nerves behind the eye, which can't be replicated even today. There's, you know, but we're not meant to understand it, because I don't think we can understand it. It's beyond our understanding.
I guess, you know, why they used analogy a lot. You know, they would use analogy, and Christ would use parables, and if you think, you know, they were able to describe things back then 3,000 years ago that we can still understand now, it's because they used analogies that they were able to describe it. Moving on to another point that he makes, he asks about the word goyim. And he's being facetious here, and he's saying, does goyim mean cattle? But it's quite interesting. The actual origins of the word goyim are quite interesting, because it wasn't always a derogatory term that Jews used, because throughout the Old Testament, the word goy is used, and it's translated as nations. And when you've got Sarah there with Abraham and Sarah, and they've got Isaac and Esau is within Sarah's belly, God says there are two goy within your belly, and one will serve the other. And many goyim will come from your loins, and they will rule the world and all the rest of it. And all these promises are made to the goyim, meaning the nations that come from Isaac. And then when you get to the New Testament, the word that was used instead of goy was Gentiles, which is the Latin version of the same, which just means nations. So these promises that were to the goyim in the Old Testament, which were the Israelites, the tribes of Israel, are to the Gentiles in the New Testament. It's exactly the same people. And then what you get the people who we now call the Jews, who are the descendants of Esau and the Canaanites mixed in with the tribe of Judah. They then took the word goy and turned it into a derogatory term and said, it means cattle, it means beasts. And they refer to us as the goyim and have turned it into a negative term. But all these promises in the Old Testament, they are to the goyim and to the Gentiles in the New. When it talks about the Gentiles in the New Testament, it means the Gentiles from Israel, the nations from Israel. That's all the word means, is nations. Exactly the same as goyim means in the Old Testament. So it's,
well, as,
you know,
as we've found, they've corrupted a few words in the times, haven't they? Socialism,
yeah.
You know.
But, I mean, it you know, it just shows you that the Jews are not the Israelites, and we are, and we've been called by the correct name, goyim. You know, it means Israelite, basically. If you look at what it says in the Old Testament, its usage in the Old Testament is for the Israelites. They're called the goyim, and yet you've got these Jews today that say, "Oh, goyim means cattle," and we're going to call non-Jews goyim.
Yeah.
And you know what they've done is they've just taken that word and given it a negative connotation to say that, oh, it doesn't actually mean Israelite anymore. It means you know, cattle, basically.
Yeah, but, well, it's like anti-Semitic. They've stole that word. That's, you know, to be Semitic is Arab, as I'm concerned.
Yeah, they confuse things as much as they can. But he gets into a couple of other topics as well. Vegetarianism, he then lets on that he's a vegetarian. And, you know, I think all you really have to do is look at Greta Thunberg to understand that vegetarianism is not what people are supposed to be eating. I mean, just look at the state of her. You know, her hormones are all messed up. She hasn't grown into an adult.
I can't picture her anyway.
You must be the only person in the world not to have heard of Greta Thunberg. This very, very badly behaved Swedish child that has been leading these school strikes, she calls them, for the climate change because she's upset about the weather. She's basically upset that her mother was a feminist and her mother neglected her, but her mother couldn't say, well, that's because I chose my career. So they basically chose the climate, and they blame the climate for what's happened to Greta, rather than blaming Greta's mother. E. Michael Jones has done a very in-depth report on all of this, but that's basically it. And so she's blaming the climate. But the point I'm making is, if you actually look at the physical state of her, that's caused by her not eating meat. She's a vegetarian, she's a vegan, and she looks like a 10-year-old child. She's 16, she should be looking like an adult, and she's not. All her hair is falling out. I mean, people say, oh, well, we used to be vegetarians, but we can't be vegetarians anymore. I mean, you used to be able to just eat one apple a day, and that would keep the doctor away. Now you have to eat 10. You have to eat 10 different bits of fruit and vegetables because there isn't enough nutrients in the fruit and vegetables. But if you're eating meat, it's all that fruit and vegetables and all that greenery has already been eaten by the animal and concentrated. So you're getting all the goodness from the animal. It's not possible to just eat vegetables and retain your good health in this day and age. And yet this guy making these comments, he's trying to say that we're supposed to be herbivores. I mean, we've got carnivorous teeth. We've got pointed fang-like teeth incisors specifically for eating into the meat. I think a lot of the times people get this idea because they look at things like Neanderthals. And they say, oh, well, look, the Neanderthals and these early humans, because they think they were humans, they say, well, they just used to eat vegetables. And they've fallen for this con that we're descended from them. And they think that it's okay if we just have a vegetarian diet, which is based on faulty science, that we are descended from, you know, these other races that were around before us. There's nothing to show we're descended from these other races.
Well, I've got to be honest, I do like a good steak.
Yeah, I love a good steak, but I mean, kind after kind, you look like your ancestors, and you don't just suddenly change into a different kind. If you've got like another humanoid that is a Neanderthal and say, well, we've got a little bit of a DNA structure that's the same as a little bit of that DNA structure in the Neanderthal, it doesn't mean we're descended from the Neanderthal. It just means that we've got a similar structure, the same as, you know, they both got two legs and we've got two legs. They had eyes and we've got eyes. Doesn't mean you're descended from them.
Having said that, I think Hitler was a vegetarian. It'd be nice if they could use him as a poster child.
He was. He was a vegetarian. I think that was one of the things that he got wrong, actually. He didn't get everything right.
They could use him as a poster child, couldn't they, really? You know, saying this is a true vegetarian.
Yeah, well, obviously this guy is, you know, he's National Socialist, or he wouldn't be commenting on your, you know, on your video.
I'm thinking of people on the left who insist on going vegan.
Well, the left should really look at what the National Socialists did for animal welfare, really.
Yeah, well,
they were the first to do that and ban vivisection. Well, Dennis, we've flown through tonight's podcast. We're going to have to cover the rest of it next week, I think. Yeah. Yeah. So I'll say thank you very much for coming on today.
Okay, no problem.
Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. We will be back next Friday. So until then, just remains for me to say have a very happy new year next week. And we'll see you next Friday.
RadioAlbion.com